Hello and welcome back to The Sound of Economics. I'm Nicholas Barrett.
And I'm Guntram Wolf.
This is the first of two podcasts on the European Green Deal. Today we're talking to Gregory Claes and Simone Tagliapetra about their new policy contribution. It's called How to Make the European Green Deal Work, and you can read it at bugle.org. Sadly, the third author, Georg Zachmann, can't be with us today in the studio, but Simone is here. So, Simone, what were you trying to say here that hasn't been said before?
Thank you, Nicholas. With this paper, our aim is really to provide a blueprint to the European Commission on how to put the European Green Deal initiative into practice. So far, we have a lot of headlines, we have a lot of political guidelines, general principles. We have been spending a couple of months looking into how to turn these ideas into practice with the tools, with the funds, with the institutional setting we currently have. And that's where really this paper becomes a seminar report. It's the first report, for our knowledge, in Europe, describing how to do this in practice. And to do that, we really focus on four key pillars of the European Green Deal, which in our way, in our vision, is really the foundational elements of this plan. The first pillar is concerning carbon pricing. The second pillar relates to sustainable investment. The third pillar relates to industrial policy. And the fourth to the just transition.
So today we're going to talk about the first two pillars, and we're going to leave the second two pillars to another podcast because we think this paper is so important and the detail is so important. So why don't you kick us off and tell us about the first pillar?
Carbon pricing is the main policy tool to drive decarbonization. That's clear. The current situation we have in Europe is not so rosy as far as carbon pricing is concerned, because only half of the European emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, are priced. And the price of the carbon remains far too low to drive significant investment change and behavioral change. So what we are proposing is to strengthen the current European emission trading system, which covers notably industry and electricity. And by strengthening it, we really mean cutting the free allowances that were given in a very generous manner to the industries over the last years in order to prompt the price up. At the same time, we think that we should deal with the non-ETS sectors, notably transportation, agriculture, and buildings, by setting minimum EU standards in terms of carbon price. So we would like to see the Commission revising the Energy Taxation Directive, setting minimum prices for carbon in these sectors. And then we would like to see countries adopting maybe more ambitious pricing at the national level according to their level of ambition, but certainly according to the national reality.
So Simone, let's just zoom in a little bit. You said only half of the current emissions are being priced. I mean, you mean priced at the European level through the European emission trading system. The other half, in particular transport and heating, which are the big two sectors where there's lots of emissions, are basically at the moment dealt with at the national level. Some countries have very high CO2 prices on heating. Sweden, for example, has very high ones. Other countries have much less significant prices, taxes on these sectors. But the reality is we have sort of, on half of our European economy, we have a European trading system, the ETS, just the abbreviation ETS is the European trading system. And on the other half, we have basically a mix of every country does a little bit what it wants. Can you just explain a little bit why and how this directive that you are proposing can guide the national policymakers? Because at the end of the day, the national policymakers really emphasize very much that this is taxation question and that's a national sovereignty question. And by the way, we are a different country to that country, and we want to emit less. We want to perhaps emit a little bit more because we are still behind in terms of development. So every country has a bit of a different approach here. And that was also very important in the climate negotiations at the global level in the Paris negotiations, where, you know, every country got its own goals. And so now all of a sudden there should be a European minimum goal? How's that gonna work, and who's gonna put that in place?
You know, the ideal way forward, if you look at economics from the textbook, let's say, would be to basically put a European carbon tax on these sectors, decided in Brussels, and that's it. That will be by far the best and most efficient way to go.
But even a global one.
Or even a global one. That would be certainly the best option.
All right.
But then you need to consider the political economy behind all this. And that's exactly the reason why we are promoting the minimum requirements, which is basically a way to set at the European level a certain minimum level of carbon price in a certain sector, exactly allowing countries to be different one another according to the national reality. Let's keep the example of transportation. President designate von der Leyen at the European Parliament has proposed to extend the ETS into the transportation sector. We don't agree with that. We
Why
think
not?
This is not going to work, because if you got the same price for carbon in the transportation sector in Poland and in France, the distributive effects you're going to have are going to be substantial. And Poland is probably not going to endorse such an approach. And therefore, we might end up in the situation in which we will not provide a sensible price on that sector in any case.
Can you just explain the distributed effect? Why would a single ETS on transport for Poland and France lead to distributive effects between France and Poland, you mean? Or
yeah, and also
can you just explain that for
I mean, there are
listeners.
Two levels of distributional effects, which we also tackle in the paper. The first relates to the fact that simply we have countries that are richer than others in Europe. So it's clear that these effects on a richer country will be socially less felt than a country with a lower level of income. That's the first problem. But then there is the second problem, which relates to the urban-rural divide. And there you got the massive issue, which ultimately led to the emergence of the Gilets Jaunes movement in France. You have people from the rural areas which are saying, why should we get this carbon price, so this taxation, while we do not have alternatives to switch away from our cars because the public transport system is weak, is not reaching the areas, and so on and so forth. Now, what we are saying in the paper is, if we are able to push the price up in the current ETS sectors already, so electricity and industry, from the current level of 25 euros per ton to a level of 40 euros per ton, we might increase the revenues under this system from 25 billion currently to 180 billion per year. Now, we should use part of these revenues to compensate the lower income households across Europe.
So for example, basically taxing industries and to fund households, because the ETS is on industry mostly.
In industry and electricity, absolutely.
And electricity.
And electricity. Right. Okay. So mm-hmm. What you are doing, you can adopt a model that is being adopted in Switzerland, in which the government provides lump sums to low-income citizens to compensate for the regressive effects of climate policies. This is the way forward in order to ensure that this society is backing up this initiative. If we don't take these measures, society is going to backlash and the transition is not going to unfold.
So if nations and regions with lower levels of GDP have afforded more flexibility to emit, does that not provide an incentive for industry just to move to those areas where they'll have more leeway?
No, but wait. Now we are referring to transport, we are referring to the building sector. This is not the issue of electricity and industry. That's why those sectors should keep remaining under the ETS as they are. Now, the question is, how do we tax the other sectors? We basically have two options. Either we expand the ETS or we find different ways at the national level with minimum EU standards to move forward. We prefer this option also because you have to consider that the ETS has been built over the last 20 years with a big deal of political effort. And opening up now the Pandora box of this system, rediscussing it, might be extremely difficult. And that's why we would rather favor the option of keeping the system as it is for the two sectors it is covering and finding out different ways to provide a sensible carbon price on the other sectors.
Well, can we talk, and Niklas already mentioned the carbon leakage issue, so the incentive for industry to move when it gets taxed more heavily. Can you walk us through this whole topic of how you see the carbon leakage problem and how to deal with the so-called border carbon adjustment? So how do we deal with the fact that if you start pricing CO2 emissions more heavily in Europe, production will shift outside. So instead of producing the car in Italy, you produce it in Turkey, for example, where your production of cars will not be subject to the emission trading system, but Turkey, then being in the customs union, will find it very easily to export those cars here to Europe. So how do we deal with this issue? How big is the issue? And I mean, of course, we have a bit of a disagreement, but I let you start on this, and then I give my point of view on this one.
Of course, Guntram, the carbon border tax has been a sort of flagship announcement in the framework of this European Green Deal, as presented by President-elect von der Leyen. The issue of carbon border adjustment has been there in the economic discussion for more than 20 years. The problem is exactly as Guntram portrayed. If you have higher carbon prices in Europe, there might be the risk that industries will relocate outside in order not to pay this carbon price, which is actually a tax, and therefore, from an industrial perspective, potentially a competitive disadvantage. Now, the answer of von der Leyen is we should get a carbon border tax in Europe, which means we should tax all the goods that are entering the European Union according to their carbon content, in order to create a level playing field which doesn't disadvantage the European companies, and therefore putting all the players at the same level. Now, from our perspective, this initiative, this idea, it's fascinating at the theoretical level. And certainly, it is an idea that should be explored. But what is the reason why, after 20 years of discussion in the economic circles, this idea has never been put into practice in one single country? Well, the reason is that this is technically possible, but difficult, because calculating the carbon content of goods requires very complex methodologies that can be source of conflicts and arguments, and one might end up in front of a court on whether a methodology is fair or not. But even assuming this is possible and viable, what we see as the real problem of all this is the politics. You would need to find, first of all, an agreement politically in Europe on how to set the right level of carbon border adjustment, but then you would immediately enter into a sort of trade war, sort of a problem, because you might well expect retaliation from other trade partners considering this carbon border measure such as basically a trade war tool from Europe. Now, what we are saying in our paper is the following. Do we have today evidences of a major carbon leakage problem in Europe? The answer is no. We don't have any evidence today of a carbon leakage problem in Europe. We have studies showing that under the ETS, we didn't have so far a carbon leakage problem. The second question is, will carbon leakage occur as the price of carbon in Europe will go from 25 euros today to 40, which is the level we wish by 5 to 10 years? The answer is we don't know, honestly. No one can say yes or no to this question. So our point is basically the following. Since we are not sure about the potential risk of carbon leakage, why should we use immediately, allow me this expression, the nuclear weapon? which is basically the carbon border tax. Let's use other tools in the meantime, as the price of carbon goes up, to deal with this potential risk. And for that, we claim in the paper we should, for example, put in place a system that fosters and supports innovation in industry in Europe. So we should basically subsidize the European industries exactly as we subsidized the electricity sector in the past to go for renewable energy. So let's try to use tools that we have ready instead of going for the most radical one that will create international consequences under the trade perspective. And basically, we don't know if this is really needed. Right. Also because, so, let me just conclude with this. Who tells you that the carbon leakage, or let's say, who tells you that the carbon price alone can define the strategies of an industry? There is a long way to go between creating an incentive to an industry to switch to a cleaner production process and to push them out of Europe. I will just conclude with an example. Over the last 15 years, we have been experiencing a major radical shift in global energy markets after the US shale gas revolution. Before the shale gas revolution in the US kicked in, Europe and the US have had basically the same prices of natural gas, which is a fundamental commodity for the industry, particularly for the energy intensive, like car makers, steel, aluminum, and so on. After the shale gas revolution, the price of gas in the US went down dramatically to a level of $3 per million BTU, while in Europe it remained at $6-$9 per million BTU. In this process, everybody panicked 10 years ago about the German car makers closing down the factories in Germany, moving to the US because of the energy cost, which is a major item of cost for these industries. Did this leakage happen? The answer is no. So why should we now be concerned about the higher carbon price that certainly will have an impact which might well be inferior to the one of energy cost upfront?
Well, I mean, so let me give my perspective on this. It seems to me that you're a little bit underestimating the risks that we have in that space. I mean, the first point is that we already have a production structure which has the more energy intensive production sites outside of Europe. So that has already happened, as including as a result of the differences in energy prices globally. We know that our imports are more carbon intensive than our exports, which is already a sign that some of the carbon is actually pushed abroad and decided, and production is at least it is a sign that we are consuming much more CO2 than we are producing, and that's already bad. And it already shows that we have an issue here. Now, then, second of all, as you rightly pointed out, when the price is very low, then price effects are not very biting on behavior of consumers, but also on decisions by companies. And I would postulate that as the CO2 price is increasing, especially as it is increasing to an extent that it actually has behavioral impact, it will at that moment also have an impact on the allocation of production between domestic and foreign. So in a sense, there isn't much carbon leakage at this stage because there isn't much of a price tag associated to CO2 emissions. I mean, that's in a nutshell the problem. Now then, I think, as you agree, we have to consider how to introduce it, and we have to be very careful how to introduce it so as not to trigger a trade war. Now, there's lots of fallacies here in the debate, sort of suggesting that border carbon adjustment amounts to green protectionism. There's all kinds of statements of that sort out there. The reality is, if you do it well, you can do it in a way that it would not discriminate foreign production relative to domestic production. On the contrary, if you don't do it, you actually discriminate domestic production against foreign production. Now, it's obviously true, Simone, that domestically we are a high-value economy, high-value added economy. So energy prices, in a sense, are only a small component of our overall production structure. Nevertheless, on the margin, these price signals matter. And if they were, if they wouldn't matter, then why even go down the trouble of doing doing a CO2 tax in the first place? And let's just wait for the service economy to solve this problem. Because if you only do services, I mean, then CO2 emissions is probably much lower than if we were to consume cars or other things. So I would say this issue is a real issue. It is a real issue that can be dealt with, and there are some proposals, and I put them forward in a recent blog post, which I call Demystifying a Border Carbon Adjustment. These issues can be addressed by and need to be addressed by a carefully crafted a way of adjusting for carbon content at the border, which I think is crucial in a number of sectors, especially those sectors that are particularly energy intensive, such as steel, cement or other sectors. They can be made WTO compatible. I think the key issue here is World Trade Organization compatible. The key issue is that they are introduced in a non-discriminatory way. And I think you could do this by having some form of a VAT equivalent CO2 tax. And of course, there's lots of technical problems. I quite agree with you that one should not immediately just announce whatever. If one does that, the Commission will have to negotiate and deal with this very, very carefully. But I think we should probably discuss also the investment side.
Before we discuss the investment side, actually, just to reconcile you and also to be clear about what we propose in the paper. First, for the discrimination of against our own industry, we propose basically subsidies to make them cleaner, which is a negative CO2 tax, to take that into account by providing this to them. And the second thing is that we have to be clear in the paper, we are not arguing against a carbon adjustment tax. What we are saying is that the Commission should work on it, but it should not be the first announcement.
But
not the details. So it can work on the detail. It can try to work on how to make it acceptable by every country, how to make it W compatible, as you say, which is very important in our view. And in the meantime, doing other stuff. In the meantime, the Commission should monitor if there is actually some carbon leakage, if price goes up from 25 to 40 or even more. And if actually those carbon leakage materialize, then we say clearly in the paper that a carbon tax, a carbon adjustment tax should
but
be
not before.
Put in
place. And if I may add on this, it's a matter of prioritization. Starting really from the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal here is to bring Europe to climate neutrality by 2050. And the intermediate goal is to decrease our emissions to 55% by 2030. That's what Ursula von der Leyen proposed. Rather than the current target we have at 40.
That's already the problem. I mean, you want to reduce emissions by 55%, but already we know that we are consuming 25% more than we emit. So if that 25 consumption goes up to 40% more, if we consume 40% more than we emit, climate change is not going to be helped much. So the increase in ambition on the targets, if that all gets lost by just shifting the more carbon intensive abroad, then we have a problem.
Yeah, but my point is that since 2030, it's really around the corner for the energy timing, because the investments being made today will last far beyond 2030, we need to get the priorities right for the next 5 years. What's happening in these 5 years, it will be crucial for the decarbonization path. So we know what needs to be done to clean up electricity, to clean up industry, to clean up transport. We need to put these policies in place. We need to work on environmental standards. We need to be stricter there and push decarbonization in the way that we have already the tools. The risk we really see is to spend 5 years discussing a measure such as carbon border tax,
which nobody disagrees with,
and we don't do the homeworks we have to do.
And you also mentioned, if I may, that I think one interesting aspect is certainly also standardization, so high standards on the car industry or other industries, are not a carbon tax. They don't require an external carbon border adjustment. They don't require a tax here, but they will still lead to some form of a decarbonization and will force all foreign producers that want to sell their cars in the European market to actually have more fuel efficient cars. But shall we talk a bit, Simone, Gregory, shall we talk a bit about the investment side?
Definitely.
Because our time is flying. So.
Yeah, no, definitely. So our second pillar is to have a green investment plan, actually. And we think that that carbon pricing, even though absolutely necessary and crucial, will not be sufficient, actually, to decarbonize before 2050, and in particular to arrive to our target of 2030 of minus 55%. What we think is that if we want to decarbonize and if we want to provide, actually, alternative to the industry and to consumers in order for them not to suffer too much, actually, from carbon prices, we need to invest a lot. So example is public transportation. A lot of people, if carbon prices goes up for transportation, and if they cannot use their car, what will they do? Then we need to invest a lot in public transportation. So
can I just ask you in a very simple, just for the layman, in a very simple, simple question on this? I mean, in a sense, if we start pricing cars a lot, don't people just switch to public transport? I mean, why investment follows automatically? Investment follows the demand. What's the issue here? Can you explain that?
Yeah, but if there is no alternative, what can you do? So we need to provide them with
this alternative.
No, it's not all public investment. Actually, there is a big part in the paper where we discuss how much additional investment is needed. And we think, actually, that a lot of additional investment is needed. According to the estimates that we have, actually, additional investment needs are around 300 billion per year. So above the proposal, actually, by Ursula von der Leyen, which is around 100 billion per year. So we think that we need to have this push investment, but of course, public investment will only be a small part of this. If you look at public investment in GDP, it's only 3% of GDP. Private investment is 17% of GDP. So of course, we are not going to reverse this proportion with the green.
But the 300 billion, how much is public, how much is private?
This is very difficult to answer that question. Actually, we didn't find any good estimate of that. So that's a bit, but most of it will come from private investment.
I was just thinking the danger is that, especially in Western Europe, the time it takes these days to get infrastructure projects finished is just staggering. So you could have the tax incentives to get people out of their cars, and then suddenly the railways will be crowded because it takes about a decade to build a tunnel under London or a train to Birmingham or an airport in Berlin or whatever it is we do next.
But that's why actually we think that the timing is crucial, and that this investment plan it should not be pushed to the next commission. Actually, it need to be brought forward, and a lot of this investment need to take place in the next 5 years. Because before car prices start biting, actually, that's when we need to provide the alternative.
And Simone, you were talking about compensating households in regions left behind by climate legislation. How would you do that?
Well, I mean, for the issue of compensating the low-income households, as we said, we can use part of the revenues from carbon pricing and redistribute them directly, as also in forms of lump sums.
Giving people money.
Absolutely. Yeah. Giving people money. Absolutely.
And this can take various forms. There is a Swiss example. There is also an example in British Columbia. But actually, there are some interesting proposals that have been given, actually, by two or three French economists after the Gilets jaunes, which is to have compensation that is not only depending on income, but also depending on geographical criteria. Because we know that there are low-income people inside big cities that have access to...
So those people can continue driving their car, even though marginally it's more expensive, but they will continue driving their car because there's no alternative, unless you do some public transport investment. Is that the point on the public investment? Can you just walk us a bit through the investment? I mean, how do you see this going forward?
Yeah, it's true that we went already to the third pillar, but that's why all those pillars are actually complementary, because we need to provide them alternatives, that's the investment part, and then we need to provide compensation, that's the third pillar, and the compensation part. Concerning investment, so as I was saying, Most of it will have to be done through private investment, but public investment will still need to play an important role. You will need to improve energy efficiency, for instance, in public buildings. You will need to improve energy efficiency in social housing. You will need to add infrastructure for railroad, for instance, if we need to replace cars by rail. So there will be a lot of public investments that will be done. And on that side, actually, the EU cannot do that much because the EU has very limited resources actually to do public investment. The main resources of the EU to do public investment is the EU budget. But we all know that the EU budget is very small. It's around 1% of GDP or 150 billion per year. And most of that is still used for agriculture and cohesion policy, even though cohesion policy part of it, of course, is investment in infrastructure. But still, it will remain a very small and marginal source of public investment. So it needs to be done, and that's why we think that greening actually the EU budget is absolutely necessary. It's necessary in the cohesion fund, but it's also actually very necessary in the agricultural part of the budget. Because, for instance, the European Court of Auditors have shown that agricultural funds are actually contributing negatively to the fight against climate change. They are damaging climate. So we need to really green the public investment and agricultural expenditure in the EU budget. That's the first thing to do. The second thing to do, actually, is that most of the public investment, actually, in Europe is done at the national level. So it's under the control of national politicians. So what can the EU do to encourage them to increase public investment? I would say that the EU, basically the Commission, has two main tools. The first one are country-specific recommendation, where they provide recommendation to each country every year in the framework of the European semester. We all know that this has not worked very well in recent years, but it's still a good thing to try to coordinate around the EU objectives. But I would say that the main tool that the Commission will have to foster public investment is actually to reform the European fiscal framework, so reform the fiscal rules. We know that during the crisis, a new tool was introduced in the fiscal framework in order to avoid countries to slash public investment, which is what we have observed actually during the crisis and the consolidation of public finances in the last crisis. So the EU introduced a so-called investment clause. However, this investment clause has not been used a lot. Actually, it has only been used twice, once by Italy and once by Finland. But the problem is that this investment clause is very restrictive. The conditions to use it are very restrictive. First, you can only use them in bad times. So when the output gap is very high. So when you're in a recession. And so that's a problem, because here our problem is different. The problem is that we want investment, not temporarily in bad times, but we want investment to grow, to finance the transition over a long period of time, maybe the next 20 to 40 years. So in that case, this investment clause should be modified in order for it not to be temporary and in order not to be only applicable in bad times. So we think that this is a way to influence public finances and to encourage member states to invest in the transition.
I mean, just on this point, which I think is a very important point, I mean, the European fiscal framework is quite constraining on public deficits, as we know, even though lots of countries circumvent the rules in all kinds of ways or try to circumvent them, and there's flexible interpretation. But the rules as such are quite restrictive on deficits. And of course, we live in a period of basically zero interest rates or even negative interest rates. So governments would actually, get paid for borrowing and investing into public infrastructure. So you're basically saying we should fundamentally reform the fiscal framework, I mean, for many reasons, but here in the green space, are you saying we should introduce some sort of a green golden rule. I mean, the golden rule is an old rule that would allow all investment to be exempted from the calculation of the deficits, because that's basically a future-oriented spending of the government, and so therefore shouldn't count in this rules. And this golden rule was very much abandoned with the fiscal compact at the time of the crisis, when the ESM was also introduced. So it was a big thing that this was actually taken away, this golden rule. Now you're saying, well, let's have some sort of a golden rule back, but let's green it. So allow investment, but only if it's green. Is that the point?
Yeah, actually, my personal view is that we should change the fiscal rules for everything, and we should allow more investment to benefit from the current negative rates. But if that's not possible, and I think it's going to be very politically challenging, at least we should do it for green investment. And what we say in the paper actually is that it should be easier for green investment, because one of the problem at the time was some countries were afraid that everything would fall into the investment category. So I think making it only possible for green investment, which actually could be defined very well. Now there is a taxonomy that the Commission is working on. So this taxonomy, and also the fact that we are going to be able to issue green bonds. So we could have well-defined green investment financed by green bonds, and this would be exempted from the fiscal rule. So this green golden rule, as you say, could be very well-defined and really constrained to green investment. And maybe this would reassure some countries that are afraid that every expenditure could be put in the green in the golden rule.
I'm interested in your opinion, Guntram. Can Germany continue to be committed to budget surplus and be serious about fighting climate change?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, so Germany has quite recently thought and toyed around with an idea of creating a more or less off-the-budget vehicle, a private foundation that would allow doing these kind of investments without that being immediately classified as deficits. And I think it's a sign. I mean, the details are not yet fully clear, but I think it's a sign that fiscal rules that are too constraining lead to these kind of creative solutions that economically in the end may be even less efficient than actual borrowing on green investments. So I think the country I know best, in my home country, there is now a debate on this. There's also a debate on reopening the fiscal rules, perhaps even looking at the German constitutional rules. There is this debate. And I think the green investment needs are so big, and there's such a widely shared discussion around this in society that if we were to succeed, and there I quite agree with Gregory, if we were to succeed the rules, this is probably our best shot in changing the rules.
Am I thinking the German word for debt is very similar to the word for guilt?
There's a little bit overplayed, I think, this linguistic point, but true. I mean, there is an association here. Perhaps one thing, the last sort of little thing, because before we close, it's just to get a sense from Gregory and Simone on the question who's actually borrowing here. I mean, because you talked about the change of the fiscal rules, which basically means it's national budgets. You're all thinking about national, but isn't there a role for the European Investment Bank or some European institution to actually issue a European even safe asset that is a European green and safe asset, which also the ECB could use? I mean, Gregory?
We don't go as far as creating a European green budget or something like this that would finance a green public investment in Europe. However, you're right that we mentioned in the paper that the European Investment Bank should be used more forcefully. Actually, the EIB has already been used in the previous plan, the Juncker plan that was created in 2015. But we think that we could continue using it, actually. And actually, the EIB in recent years has not been investing that much. If you look at his balance sheet, it has been going down in recent years. So we think the EIB should be used more forcefully for the Green Deal. And it has the absolute leeway to do it. It has a good capital ratio, lower leverage than before, etc. So it has some leeway and should be used actually to finance part of the transition. And the EIB, as an EU institution that is guaranteed by its member state, benefit from those negative rates that you were mentioning. I checked a few weeks ago, and I think they borrowed at like 15 years at 0.05%. So, and at smaller, at shorter maturity, the rates are also negative. So that would be a good way to invest at the European level, to use the European Investment Bank.
If I may, this for Europe, but this also works for the export dimension of the European Green Deal. What we also say in the paper is that given the fact that Europe only generates 10% of the world greenhouse gas emissions, if we are serious about leading decarbonization, we need to push the European Green Deal beyond our borders. And we sympathize with the idea of turning also the EIB into the European Climate and Sustainable Investment Bank in order to really push clean investments in developing countries, for example, in clean electrification in Africa, which would be a tool of climate policy, but also of industrial policy to promote our industry beyond our borders, and ultimately also a tool of foreign policy, which in times of the geopolitical commission, as Ursula von der Leyen defined his forthcoming commission, I think it's something that is really quite relevant.
Well, thank you very much for this. I think it was a really interesting discussion. I think we really got into the weeds of the paper, which you can read at bruegel.org. It's called How to Make the European Green Deal Work. I think that was excellent. Thank you, Simone Tagliapetra. Thank you, Gregory Claes. Thank you, Guntram Wolf. And next week, we'll be back to carry on this discussion. We will be talking about the potential political consequences of an effective European Green Deal and how to prevent them. So do join us for that. And thank you very much for listening. Bye.